The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 179.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hi guys, how's everyone doing today? Welcome to Sunday's live stream. I just got back from the gym, so I'm looking good. I'm hot, I'm sweaty, and I'm ready to answer some questions. That always gets me in the mood, doing some squats so I can't even move my legs right now. Couple of announcements. First and foremost, make sure you check out Rebel Capitalist Pro. That is the online investment forum I have with Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh. It is the best way to build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. So make sure you check it out at georgegammon.com/pro. That would be one. And by the way, it has all of Lynn's research and Chris's insider weekly reports. So including live streams just like this one for members. Anyway, out. Announcement number two. I am seriously contemplating creating another YouTube channel. And in fact, I've already created another YouTube channel, but it doesn't have any content on it. I'm going to start uploading content tomorrow morning. So what is this YouTube channel? You may be asking yourself. Very good question. I'm thinking about doing a news YouTube video. So like 2 to 3 times per day, I find an interesting article or chart, or maybe it's the Fed's balance sheet or something that's going on with the Chinese digital currency or inflation, Bitcoin, who knows, gold, the gold miners, any of the things that I think are interesting from a macroeconomic standpoint. And I do a quick, like maybe 10-minute video on what I think the most interesting news of the day is, or maybe the last couple days, something like that. And so I think that's what we're going to do. I'd like it to be kind of a video version of Zero Hedge. So obviously, initially, it's going to probably not be that great. It'll probably suck. But like everything else, I as an entrepreneur, I kind of dive in head first. I shoot first, ask questions later. I keep iterating and iterating and iterating. And after a while, you got something that's decent. It's the exact same thing I did with my YouTube channel, which, by the way, increased by 205,000 subscribers in 2020, got 17 million views. So if I was able to do that after about a year, a little over a year, I think I can do pretty darn decent with another kind of a video Zero Hedge. So anyway, all right, guys, let me go ahead and dive into the questions. That's why you are all here, and I'm ready to answer them for you after some brutal rounds of squats. I'm not very good at squats, but I got to do them because it's just, I got scoliosis in my knees, and it's just everything seems to function better when I do squats. Okay, Snyder and Van Meter say massive M2 amounts should equate to inflation, but they can't make it happen. What are your thoughts on inflation, deflation ahead? Well, they can't make it happen. So that would imply that they can't do it the way the system is currently set up. And I think all of us in kind of the macro FinTwit space, and let's be honest, guys, I'm only an amateur. I mean, I don't want to ever put myself at the same level as Steve or Jeff or Brent or Luke or Lynn or any of these people. I mean, listen, I'm not thinking at that. Well, I might be thinking at that level, but these people are way smarter than I am. They're pros. I'm merely an amateur. So I don't want to put myself at that level. But the bottom line is I've got, for whatever reason, a lot of people follow me on Twitter. Who knows why they do it? I don't know. Maybe they're all crazy. They're probably as crazy as I am. But let's get back to your question here. I think all of us would agree that if the system stays as is, yeah, we're all deflationists. I mean, Lynn, Luke, we're all deflationists. But if the system changes, then Snyder, and I'm not sure about Steve. I just went back and forth with Steve today on Twitter, so I'm going to be interviewing him in the next few weeks here. But I know Dr. Lacey Hunt has said that if the system changes and they start turning bank reserves into legal tender, then even he would become an inflationist. And I think that Russell Napier also has a very good argument for going from an inflationist stance to, or excuse me, a deflationist stance over to an inflationist stance. And even Snyder, I believe, I don't want to put words in his mouth, would suggest that the commercial banking system is really kind of the be-all end-all for the true money supply in an economy. And therefore, if you can do something, you mean the government or the Fed, to guarantee, let's say, the loans that they're doing, so there's kind of the risk reward makes a lot of sense for the commercial banks, then you get back into the system where the euro dollar is, or that euro dollar market is operating like it did pre-2008, and yeah, maybe you're probably going to get some inflation, which with as large as the deficits are, and with the Fed monetizing all that debt, and with the fiscal deficit and the trade deficit. So I think it's not, my point is, I don't know that anyone's an inflationist or deflationist. I think that where any of us differ is just, is the system going to stay the same, or is the system going to be the same next year as it is this year or today, right now, as we speak? And I would argue that, the probabilities are the system will change, and by this time next year, we'll be using those bank reserves as legal tender, or at least maybe 2 years. And that's really where we differ opinion. It's not really on the inflation deflation stuff. Could you please return the live events to early schedule? Hard time watching these from, well, yeah. Here's the good news, Vladimir. Is on the new channel that I talked about, which is called just Rebel Capitalist. And I don't even think it's searchable on YouTube right now. So you'd have to follow that link. It'll probably be searchable once I upload some content for like a week or so. But those news reports that I do with charts or blog posts, or I was thinking about even doing tweets, like when Grohman or Snyder or Lynn does a really cool tweet, like do like a news report on their tweet, kind of explaining it really quick. And I want to be very clear that this is not going to replace the George Gammon YouTube channel. The George Gammon YouTube channel will continue to create the exact same content that we have, or that we were creating in 2020 and 2019. Nothing's going to change there. Don't worry about that. This is just additional content that I'm planning on creating for YouTube. So anyway, my point is that I was just going to do live streams because I won't doing like two or three videos a day. I don't have time to edit them. So I was just going to do a live stream and then pull up charts and everything as I'm talking about them. I'll probably be doing like three live streams a day for this news channel. So you'll probably get sick and tired of watching me live. And I was thinking about doing like the first one at like 9 o'clock in the morning, and just whenever something came across my research that I found interesting. So who knows? That could be 9 o'clock in the morning, like Eastern time, 9 o'clock, noon Eastern time, 3 o'clock. It'd be somewhere between 9 and 5 Eastern time. So you'll get plenty of that, buddy. Don't worry about it. What is the one thing or secret to your massive success you have never told anyone ever? Are you secret society member? I mean, I'm pretty much an open book. I'll answer any question. Like, I'll answer anything. But I don't know if there's one thing that I've never told anyone. The secret to being successful is you've got to work your ass off. You've got to be willing to sacrifice things that other people are not willing to sacrifice. You've got to be incredibly good at problem solving, and you have to be very good at managing people. If you've got those three things, it's not a matter of if you're going to be successful. In my opinion, it's just a matter of when. Luck has nothing to do with it. The only thing that luck has to do with is when you're successful. Like if you get a little lucky, you'll be successful earlier. But luck isn't going to be the determining factor that will make you successful or not if you have those three skill sets. I think the main thing is blackjack. That's what most people don't really get. And that would be kind of, I guess, a secret. But I've talked about it. But that's kind of the one unique thing that I do that I don't really hear anyone talk about that has led to a lot of my success in business and investing. And that's learning how to play blackjack. So get out there and read Ed Thorpe's Beat the Dealer, and that'll give you a huge edge. Will real estate be a better investment in the U.S. or abroad in 2000? Well, I mean, it just depends on where it's cheap. I'd rather be invested in the United States and in Canada or Australia, but I'd rather be invested in Medellin, Colombia than the United States. So that's a pretty broad question. It all just boils down to the numbers and the RV ratios. Fortunately, the way that you determine whether or not you should buy real estate, that doesn't change, whether it's in the United States, whether it's outside. It's real estate's real estate at the end of the day. And so once you learn how to do it well in the United States, I think you can do it well anywhere as long as you take the time to know the local market. I don't know if you guys follow me on Twitter, but I was talking about Tanzania the other day. There's this little kid that's really blown up on YouTube. He started in Medellin as just kind of a vlogger. And I know him from, I don't know him personally, but I know him from being, you know, in the Medellin area. And I just watched one of his videos. He's in Tanzania right now. And he was walking through the malls and there's zero lockdowns, there's zero masks, there's zero mandates, there's none of that stuff. So I'm not saying, you know, everyone can have a different opinion on that. But me personally, the way I like to live is I would prefer to go to a place where they're not forcing you to wear a mask. You kind of have some freedom there. So I think it could be really interesting. And I've heard Jim Rogers talk about Tanzania. I talked to Tim Stermos, I think I'm pronouncing his last name correctly, good buddies with Chris McIntosh about Tanzania. I think he's got a fund where he's investing in Tanzania. And so long story short, I think as soon as I get done with Phoenix, I'm probably going to go there. I'm probably going to make a trip because I want to check out all the places that don't have mask mandates and just kind of get a vibe for what's going on. So I might go to Sweden, maybe not long. And then I might go to Belarus, because Belarus doesn't have any restrictions from what I can tell. And then from there, I think I'm going to go down to Tanzania and hang out for a while. But each one of these places, I'll be looking at real estate. And as you guys know, the end game is to go to Dubai. But I don't want to go to Dubai if it's still really strict there. If they loosen up a bit, I'd love to go, because long term, you know, that's where I think the real opportunity is with real estate investing. Now, keep in mind, I haven't done any boots on the ground research. So when I do boots on the ground research, my opinion could completely change. I'm agnostic. I'm not married to any one idea. But when I go look at real estate in those areas, it's just, I know I'm a real estate expert, but you gotta be there physically. You gotta see and understand the neighborhoods, and you gotta do all that homework before you can even consider putting any money to work there. So that's always the first step for me, is to go there, hang out for a week or two, check out the malls, just go jogging in the morning in the city centers, just get a vibe for everything. That's how I start the process of trying to determine if I want to do business somewhere or if I want to do real estate. That goes all the way back to my days as an entrepreneur. That's exactly what I used to do. So when I'm doing that, I'll be doing live streams, or I'll even be doing the whiteboard videos from my hotel room or whatever, or the news show from my hotel room in Tanzania or whatever it is. So anyway, I'll take you guys along with me for the ride. Will Biden administration lead to hyperinflation? I don't know that it'll lead to hyperinflation, but what I can say is there will most likely be more inflationary tailwind with a Biden administration, because they're most likely going to institute some form of permanent stimulus. And whether it's UBI, I don't know what they're going to call it, freedom, dividend, who knows. But I think that's going to be a permanent part of the future. I don't think that's going away anytime soon at all, unless we got inflation. But, you know, of course, that all depends on how easily he can do things based on what the Senate and the House look like and all that stuff. But I don't know that, you know, it increases the probability a couple points, but it's definitely not a guarantee, especially hyperinflation. How are you defining hyperinflation? Is that like 50% per annum? Is it 100%? Is it 10, 20? You know, I don't know what your definition of hyperinflation is. I think it's more realistic that we just have stagflation. And when I mean stagflation, I'm talking about high structural, high unemployment and inflation hovering around 10%. And when I'm talking about inflation, I'm talking about consumer price inflation. We could have asset deflation at the same time. The dollar could go up on the Dixie at the same time. And there's a lot of moving parts there, right? So I'm just talking about consumer price inflation. And in some of my videos, when I talk about the dollar losing reserve status or anything, these things, listen, guys, I'm talking about like 10, 15 years down the road. A lot of people, when I talk about those things in my videos, they kind of interpret it to mean that I think the dollar is going to lose its reserve currency status next month or something. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm just basically walking you through a thought experiment as to how it could happen, and that the dollar is slowly being used less. That doesn't mean that that Brent Johnson isn't going to be right in the end, where the dollar would spike. The dollar can be used less and less, and the dollar still spikes because there's less dollar or higher dollars created. Okay, the euro dollar system. Well, if they're not creating more debt. And I walked over this, I walked through this with Brent. It means that there's less dollars being created, but the debt still exists. If the velocity slows down, you could see dollars being used less as a percentage of overall currencies globally, while at the same time, the dollar is increasing in value on the DXY. And then how do you know what the ECB is going to do? Maybe they do something that's even more crazy when it comes to their M2 or broad money or deposits in the commercial banking system, however you want to measure it, or whatever term you want to use to measure how many currency units are in the real economy chasing goods and services. So it's just a lot of moving parts. I think what most people would be better off doing, I think I talked about this Friday night on the live stream, is instead of trying to figure out what currency is going to win, like, is it dollars? Is it yuan? Is it Bitcoin? Is it gold? Are euros, yen? I think you'd be better served to think about it in terms of a network. So I see the reserve currency, or I see currencies as competing networks, if we're talking about for the world reserve currency. So what is the network that's around the yen right now? What is the network that's around the euro? What is the network around the dollar? Well, we know the network around the dollar is huge, is massive. And it would be very difficult to dethrone that network because it's so entrenched and it's so ingrained in the global monetary system. Not just the global monetary system, but the way, really the way the globe does business. The dollar and that network of the dollar and dollar funding and repo and the euro dollar market, it's almost one in the same with the way the globe does business. So to equal that would be extraordinarily difficult, but possible. And I think it can happen very slowly, just very slowly. It doesn't happen overnight. And I think that when you look at the network that's being created by the digital yuan, you see like the Belt Road Initiative, what they're doing in Africa, South America, India, Eastern Europe, and you're seeing all of the FDI, all the foreign direct investment. You're seeing all these people that could be using a digital yuan and could have a bank account directly with the PBOC, and that they could create bank reserves and use as legal tender, directly borrowing from the central bank. By the way, it doesn't have a, they can be insolvent all they want. They don't have to be paid back. So what does that mean? That means that you've got that means that your network has advantage. Why? Because you can issue credit theoretically much cheaper than a network that would require for their debt to be paid back. So right now, the way that the dollar network works, it's issued by commercial banks. Well, commercial banks have P&Ls. They have a balance sheet. They cannot be insolvent. They cannot just issue $1 trillion worth of loans without having to be paid back or without having to worry about that. If they don't get paid back, they're belly up. They're done. So they would require a higher interest rate than a lending institution that didn't have the need to be paid back, or if they got paid back on half or something like that, whatever, we'll just print more bank reserves, who cares? So it's a whole different ballgame when you're dealing with a central bank, or when you're dealing with the central bank's balance sheet, than when you're dealing with the balance sheet of commercial banks. And I totally get it that I'm way over generalizing, of course, and there's a lot of minutia that I'm not going over and not really thinking through. I totally get it. I'm just looking at this from a 30,000 foot view. But the bottom line is, how much benefit does that add to the network where you can get, I mean, let's look at it this way. Look at what happened with the dollar back in, what was it, 2010 or so, when it went down to 70 or 71 on the why happened. All of these entities outside of the United States, whether it was countries or corporations, they loaded up on dollar denominated debt. Why? Was it because the dollar was the best fiat currency out there, and because they trusted that the central bank wouldn't print more of them and that they would be more scarce than the euro or whatever? No, the dollar was tanking at the time. The reason they took on all that dollar denominated debt is because they got cheap interest rates. You see, the money was cheaper and they thought it would continue to get cheaper, meaning that they could pay back in devalued dollars, right? So that was why there was that boom in dollar-denominated debt that is really at the core of Brent Johnson's dollar milkshake theory. Okay, well, why, if you're a corporation in Africa, let's say, and you've got the ability, and let's say you need $100,000. Well, you could get the equivalent of a $100,000 loan from the PBOC at 1% interest, or you could get it in dollars from your local bank at 5% interest. Well, what are you going to do? You're going to take it from the central bank. And by the way, if you run into trouble, the central bank can bail you out without you having to go through a commercial bank, which is what happens right now, even if the Fed creates swap lines. Because if the Fed creates swap lines, it's not like the businesses access those swap lines. No, the entities that access the swap lines are the commercial banks. So who cares how many dollars they have access to if they're not willing to create dollar-denominated loans to the corporations because the corporations have a solvency problem, not a liquidity problem. Guess what? The corporations aren't getting money. But if they had a if the corporation had a direct access to the Fed or the PBOC in this case, then bam, there you go. There's more money. And we don't care. You take it. Who cares? We have an infinite balance sheet. See? So you get it? That's why it's one of the main reasons why I think that China has an edge there as far as the network that they already have established to a certain degree with their digital currency. Then you could say, well, George, well, the Fed can go ahead and issue the Fed coin, and they already have that dollar infrastructure in place or that network. And to a certain degree, they do, but they're way behind. And I'm not saying that the yuan is going to beat the dollar as far as the central bank digital currency. I'm just head start. And you really need to be cognizant of three major networks right now. The future Fed coin, which obviously we'll get at some point in time. The digital yuan, the DCEP, and Bitcoin. Those are the three. Now, who will win? I don't know. I mean, obviously the Bitcoin guys say, oh, it's no brainer, Bitcoin. Okay. And I hope so, but I don't think they're taking into consideration debt and the price of debt. Because out of those three systems, where are interest rates going to be highest? Bitcoin. If you're lending your Bitcoin to someone else, I can assure you, you're going to charge them a higher interest rate than the PBOC is going to charge corporation XYZ in Africa. Why? Because you want your Bitcoin back. Not only do you want your Bitcoin back, but you want it at a decent rate of interest because your balance sheet matters. Your P&L matters. You can't just print those Bitcoin whenever you want to, right? So I get the scarcity argument. But there's a lot of cross currents there that I don't think people are paying attention to. And I hope Bitcoin wins, but we'll see. It's by no means a guarantee, that's for sure. There are certainties. There are no certainties, only probabilities. All right, wild, wild, wild tangent there. Sorry about that, guys. But I just think that's really important stuff to talk about.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
What are solutions you have brainstormed to maintain freedom and a good quality of life when the Great Reset? Well, I think what you have to do, Jesse, is you have to look at what countries aren't going to play ball. And it's pretty obvious right now that that countries like Belarus and Tanzania are not going to play ball with Klaus and Wigglesworth. They're basically giving them the huge middle finger right now. They don't want anything to do with the World Economic Forum or the IMF or any of these things. So, but then Sweden too. I mean, Sweden is giving them the middle finger as of right now. But you have to look at long term from an economic standpoint, who benefits from those policies and who doesn't, right? Places like Russia, the Middle East, Brazil, they do not benefit from those policies. So I mean, I don't know why they would adopt policies that aren't in line. And in fact, the good news, but I think there are actually fewer places that are going to buy into the nonsense than fewer places on earth that are going to buy into the kind of the Great Reset agenda. Meaning, like, if you go down a list of countries that are really gung-ho on this, I mean, you're just looking at Canada, the United States, Western Europe, New Zealand, and Australia. It's a big world out there. So my point is there are more countries, I think, they'll most likely give them the finger. There's some on the edge there, like, you know, South America, I don't really know. In the developing market, it would be almost impossible to execute almost any part of their game plan. I mean, an electrification of the economy, no way, no way. It's just not happening. They don't even have the infrastructure for petroleum products, let alone electricity. I mean, you got to understand, being in the United States, the whole world isn't the United States. I mean, I was in Colombia for, 5 years, on and off. I never saw a Tesla, not even one. I never saw an electric car. Oh, I take that back. I did see an electric car. They've got a couple of those of the BMWs. What is it, the i3? I think that's the electric car. But very, very few of them. And then how about banning cash? Right. Try going to a developing country like Ecuador or Colombia and just go walk around town or walk around, especially the outskirts, for a week or so. Look at how many transactions are done in cash. Like 99.9%. If you just, there's no way you could ban cash. It's just not possible. So anyway, you get my point. Is there a lot of countries that are so far behind as far as from an economic development standpoint that it's even less likely that they'll adopt these policies? So that's the main thing you can do, is just look at countries. Yeah, I mean, you'd rather live in a hermit up in the mountains. I mean, yeah, you could do that. But personally, I'd rather live in some awesome place like Dubai or you know, Belarus or who knows where. I mean, there's a lot of awesome places out there where you could enjoy what I would argue is even a better quality of life than in the United States, because the quality of life is the same, but the cost of living is much lower. Therefore, your standard of living on the same income would increase dramatically. So you're talking about a better life at half the price and in a place where you're going to have a heck of a lot more personal freedom. So I'm not too pessimistic. I'm not one of those people that thinks that Klaus is going to take over the world and there's just nothing we can do about it. I don't know. I think we need to be cognizant of Klaus and Bigglesworth and the whole crew there. But I think there's going to be places that freedom-loving individuals can still enjoy their life. And I want to believe that there's going to be more of those places than there are places that buy into the nonsense, the central planning, let's say it that way. Does it make sense to analyze stocks relative to money supply? That is a good question. Here's why I wouldn't. Because at the end of the day, the PE ratio is a price to earnings mechanism. Therefore, the money supply should, an increase in money supply equate to increase in earnings, which decrease the price to earnings ratio or make the stock price itself go up, all things equal. Therefore, if the price to earnings ratio was at all time highs, regardless of what the money supply was doing, that would tell us that the increase in money supply was not going to the bottom line of XYZ Corporation. I think how I look at that, Robbie, is very similar to the way I look at the overall housing prices adjusted for inflation relative to money supply. So you could say right now or another way, you know, a lot of times you look at housing adjusted for inflation, you say, well, if you actually adjust for the correct inflation rate, then housing would be a lot cheaper, because if they're going off the CPI, then they're adjusting that price down, let's say 2 or 3% per annum, where if they're going off the correct CPI, maybe they'd be adjusting it down by 5 or 6% and compounded over time. That's a big number that really affects that real price. But my pushback there is that, fine, if you do that, yeah, the price overall might be a little bit better, but then you're going to have to look at your price to income levels. And if you adjust the price down by 5% per annum, you've got to do that to income as well. And people are buying houses with incomes. So just because the price might go down, looking at the price to income, it doesn't change. And the only reason that long-term chart that I always use going back to 1900 works is because usually incomes stay consistent with the rate of inflation. But my point is if the incomes are not staying consistent with the rate of inflation, then you'd have to look at that long-term historic trend line, and it would actually have to be lower than it otherwise was, because whether it's 1900 or 2020, 2021, people are buying house with income. See, so that's kind of the same way it lends. That's the framework that I'd use to think through your question, which is a very good one. Very good one. I would think that yes, if it does, if you do look at that and it does benefit it because money supply has gone up so much, but stocks prices haven't gone down. Therefore, adjusted for money supply, the prices might be, I'm not going to say they're cheap, but might be a little cheaper. But then you'd also have to adjust the earnings as well. And the earnings, I don't know about adjusting the earnings, but you'd also have to take into consideration that the earnings are not going up with the rate of money supply. That's how I want to say it. A lot of people say to only have 5 to 10% allocation gold. I'm finding it hard to put money into anything else other than gold and silver at this point, everything else in a bubble. I don't know about that. I think there's some cheap commodity producers, Johnny. I think there's some foreign stocks that are really cheap. All you just use this to plug Rebel Capital's Pro. If you don't know anything that's cheap, if everything looks like it's in a bubble, then you need to be a member of Rebel Capitalist Pro, shameless plug. I know. But no, seriously, that's exactly what we talk about with Lynn and Chris, with our members. And there's tons of stuff out there that's cheap. Believe me, there is. You just got to get outside of your box. You most likely get outside of your comfort zone. And you have to be willing to invest in stocks overseas. And you have to be willing to invest in some things that you don't see on CNBC every day, or maybe some things that are hated. But another thing too, let's remember what Jim Rogers has taught us, going back to the Market Wizards books. And Jim Rogers, what he said back to Jack Schwager, and I believe it was the late 80s, and I actually asked Jim about this myself when I had the opportunity to interview him. And I'm going to actually be reaching out to Jim here soon to get him on the show again. But we talked about what he said to Jack, and he said, listen, all I do is sit and wait for a big pile of money to show up in the corner. And when I see it, I just go pick it up. And if I don't see a big pile of money sitting in the corner, I do nothing. I just sit and do nothing. And that's just classic Jim Rogers, that people think he's so simplistic and he oversimplifies everything. But there's genius in his simplicity, very much like my father. I mean, I don't want to go down that path, but my goodness, that's exactly how my father was, just like Jim Rogers, in the way that they teach. You know, it seems overly simplistic, but you think it through later on, and you understand the genius. So my point is, number one, there are some things that are out there that are cheap. If you get outside maybe your comfort zone, let's say, or maybe what you're accustomed to looking at. And number two, don't be afraid to do nothing and just wait for a pile of money to show up just sitting over there in the corner. And when you sit, make sure you go pick it up, but don't worry about doing nothing. And I know the argument against it. You're just going to have cash, and it's the value of the cash is going to be eaten away by inflation. I get it. But it's almost like at a certain point, it's worth having the negative carry on the liquidity. So, and you can get real cute by buying real estate and having a line of credit against it. But, you know, for the average Joe, that's probably overcomplicating things. So I'm not saying be all in cash, and I'm not saying that I would ignore inflation and how it deteriorates the value of cash. But I would say that I think, especially now with prices of the S&P so high, and there, to your point, there are a lot of bubbles out there. Negative carry on cash for the optionality of the liquidity. Personally, it's something I'm okay with. To have a little bit, you know, not 100% or anything. I plan to retire in South America. Would it be wise to move to Puerto Rico first versus Florida, Texas, zero tax if I don't plan to open a business, only have cash? So, I mean, if you've got like, you just have to, it depends how much. I've never really thought about it other than from a standpoint of just cash flow and business, because that's how it was most applicable to me. I mean, if you've got like $10 million in capital gains, and I don't know how much retirement income you have, and like $500K a year in retirement income, maybe you got a bunch of rental properties or something, I don't know. Or maybe you got a business that you retired from that continues to pay that you get benefits from. It could make sense. I mean, it'll probably cost you $10,000 to set everything up. You'd have to be in Puerto Rico 6 months a year unless you traveled extensively and didn't want to spend much time in the U.S. But I mean, the savings compared to Florida and Texas is staggering. I mean, it's not. You can't really compare Florida and Texas with Puerto Rico. I mean, because you're still paying federal with Florida and Texas. You're still paying, let's call it 35-40%, where Puerto Rico, you're paying zero. So, I mean, it's a significant difference. So, I think just check it out. I would suggest talking to a tax person that understands Puerto Rico well. And maybe talking to my attorney down there. If you want to email my assistant, she can give you the guy's number that I use. Just tell him that you talk to me on a live stream, or you're one of my subscribers on my YouTube channel. And just tell him your personal situation, and he can tell you whether or not he would move forward. My assistant's email, her name is Adriana, and it's contact@georgegammon.com. So just email her and say, hey, Adriana, I just spoke with George on the live stream, and I was wondering if I could get the contact information for George's lawyer in Puerto Rico so I could go over my personal situation with him and just, you know, just give him a ring. Should I wait to purchase a home for myself right now while rates are low, or wait for the housing to correct? It all depends on the numbers. I mean, if you've got a great place in a great neighborhood, starter home that you could rent, and I, even if it is your main residence, I still look at things from an RV standpoint, RV ratio, so rent to value. And I mean, if it's got a good RV ratio, then yeah, go ahead and buy it. If it doesn't have a good RV ratio, then rent it. And I just don't know where you are. So I you got to start with those numbers. As a young entrepreneur, would you be bullish on moving from non-essential service business into a more essential business as the prices you charge can move with inflation? I just think that's a tough question, because I don't know the non-essential business you're talking about. The first thing that came into my mind, and I'd have to think this through, But I think for the most part, a non-essential business is probably going to have higher margins. I guess it depends what it is. The first few non-essential businesses that came into my mind had higher margins than the essential business. Therefore, yeah, you might not be able to raise your prices, but your margins are higher. I think it really depends. I don't know, man. I don't think I'd let that come into my decision-making process. You got to move forward with where are you an expert and what do you like doing? And if you hate a business that you're considering that's an essential business, no, I wouldn't do it just because of inflation. That's good because you're going to be miserable. And if you're miserable, you're going to suck at the business. It's not going to make any money. And then where are you an expert? Like if you're a real estate expert, that might be, let's say you're Ken McElroy. Although he does apartment complex, like that's probably not a good example. But my point is with Ken McElroy, if you guys haven't watched that interview, if you're interested in real estate, you got to check it out because Kenny is an absolute pro. And he just is just such an honest guy and he's just so helpful. He just gives you just value bomb after value bomb in that interview. But he knows commercial, he knows multifamily. So, his first gig in college was a property management gig, and he learned that for like the next decade. And now he started funds. He owns hundreds of millions of dollars worth of multifamily apartment complexes. He knows that business in and out like the back of his hand. So, let's just say he came to the conclusion that business might not do as well in an inflationary environment, although it will, but let's just say that it didn't, right? Let's say it had more headwind in an inflationary environment. It's still not a good idea for Kenny to transition into restaurants, let's say. That business, even if there's a little more tailwind, it's not all about the tailwind and headwind. I think we can, when we're investing and we're speculating, we should be cognizant of those facts. But when we're looking at things from a standpoint of a business that we want to own and operate as an entrepreneur, I think although those macro elements are important, they're not as important as where is your expertise and what do you enjoy doing? I think those components should be a priority over the macro stuff. Although I think you can do the macro stuff. Hopefully that makes sense. Oh, that's easy. What if your field of expertise is difficult to start a business without online? Done. Like biotech, dude, start a YouTube channel on biotech because you got 2 billion people on YouTube. So that's where like having a niche area of expertise is actually beneficial. Super beneficial. Like you could start a YouTube channel on this, talk about it, just like I did with macro. I mean, I'm a perfect example of that. If I came to you, let's say there was no George Gammon channel and there was no Mark Moss or anything like that. And someone came to you like 2 years ago or whatever and said, hey, I've got this great idea. I'm going to start a YouTube channel on macroeconomics and talk about the repo market and quantitative easing and the Fed and the Chinese digital currency. They'd look at you and be like, what? That is the dumbest idea I have ever heard of in my life. No one is ever going to watch that channel. You could say the same thing about biotech, right? It's very similar in the sense that it's kind of a real niche type of topic. And listen, if I can pull it off with macro, you can pull it off with biotech. Doesn't a fixed money supply mean your return will generally be positive in real without interest rate? Well, Martin, your return. So I think you're talking about if you just parked your money in a bank. And yeah. I mean, with a fixed money supply, you're most likely going to have deflation. Although, let's remember, it's all... it's still dependent upon the banking system, right? We like to think that, like, during the gold standard, we had strong money because the money supply couldn't be manipulated. But that's not correct. That's not correct because we had fractional reserve banking. Now, we had something called free banking up until the Civil War in the United States. And that's where the banks themselves would issue their own currency based on, so basically IOUs, based on the amount of gold and but they're still increasing, they're still, it's still fractional reserve, right? So they're, it's not a one-to-one thing. So they're still in charge of increasing the money supply. And we had that throughout the majority of the 1800s, where, as most of us know, we had deflation. The prices at in the year 1900 were below the prices in 1800. So you had gradual deflation, but at the same time, you had the banking system in charge of inflating the money supply. You didn't have a one-to-one unless you have full reserve banking. And the banks aren't creating any additional money supply. Mises actually preferred full banking, and he acknowledged the fact that although you're not going to have the exact amount of the, let's see, how can I say this? The amount of available debt will not match, or won't potentially match the amount of demand for productive loans. But he argued that over the long run, it would be better because you wouldn't have a boom-bust cycle that was created by fractional reserve banking, and you wouldn't have a misallocation of resources and malinvestment. So over the long run, the economy would be healthier without the bank's ability to create the exact amount of money supply to match up with the demand for productive loans. You see? My point is that most people think that under a gold standard or something, the money supply just can't increase and we have a fixed money supply. That's not true. It's not true. And it wouldn't be true under a Bitcoin standard either. That the Bitcoin guys, I don't know what they're thinking, but they like to think that Bitcoin would be full reserve. So you'd only have the 21 million, but it's just not, in my opinion, that's not realistic because we as human beings would eventually end up creating IOUs for those Bitcoin so we could create more and more loans to grow the economy or to consume or do whatever. And it's why do I think that? Because that's what happened in the past. That's what happened in history. You know, how did we go from full reserve banking to fractional reserve? That wasn't by government mandate. Like, the government didn't come in and say, oh, let's throw in a central bank. And now that we've got a central bank, let's just throw in FDIC insurance and woohoo, just reserve requirements. And all you guys can start lending or creating money that doesn't exist out of thin air. All right. No. The free market created fractional reserve banking. When we had a fixed money supply, let's say, in the form of gold. So if the free market created a fractional reserve system with gold, like, why wouldn't they do it with Bitcoin? And I get the argument. Well, there wouldn't be any banks because it would be completely decentralized because you don't need to store your Bitcoin in a bank like gold. You can store it in your back pocket. Okay, I get it. But there would still be demand for loans. And if there's demand for loans, then there would be opportunity, let's say, to lend out your Bitcoin for an interest rate. And you don't want to go through the hassle of doing that. So you'd most likely give your Bitcoin or a certain percentage of your Bitcoin to a centralized group called a VC fund, angel investor, whatever you want to call them. And then they would lend out your Bitcoin. But at a certain point, there's going to be funds that pop up that are going to be lending out Bitcoin on a fractional reserve basis. And they're going to get something. Now, not everyone is going to give their Bitcoin to them, but some people would because they want the increased return. So then you're right back where you started to a certain degree, right? So anyway, bottom line, and I went off on another tangent there. Sorry about that. Doesn't a fixed money supply mean you're... So theoretically, yes. I mean, if you've got a fixed money supply, if you had free banking, I think that's a better way to say it, because with free banking, the money supply isn't fixed, but there isn't any government involvement. The government really didn't get in the game until the Civil War. And then, of course, in 1913, we all know what happened then. That's when they started the Fed. And we went from a free type of free banking to like nationalized banking to central banking. And as long as we're letting the free market work, I mean, in the 1800s, we still, with fractional reserve banking, with a money supply that really wasn't fixed. I mean, I guess you could argue base money was, but base money really wasn't either, because then what would happen is when you had a trade deficit, then there would be more gold leaving your economy, and that gold would go to economy ABC, and then their money supply would increase, right? So their money supply increases. What happens? Then it's the price speed that David Hume outlined this way back in the days of Adam Smith, the price species flow mechanism. I've talked about it in a couple of my videos. But we like to think that oh well, if we had a gold standard or a Bitcoin standard, that the money supply would never increase. No. If we run a trade deficit, then we send more Bitcoin or more gold to company or country XYZ that had a trade surplus with us, then their money supply does what? It increases. And what happens to prices when their money increases? The prices go up, right? And if the prices go up, that makes their exports less attractive. And then our exports become a little more attractive. Therefore, technically, you know, all else being equal, then our exports go up. Then the next year, or whatever, we have more gold or Bitcoin come into our economy. And then you just go back and forth and you have kind of this equilibrium. But it doesn't necessarily mean that just because there's 21 million Bitcoin, that the Bitcoin in your area, your country, your city, or whatever, the money supply doesn't increase. Even with full reserve banking, it would still increase with trade flows.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Here's something I've been talking about recently, and I want to clarify. So Catherine has asked me, do I believe in wearing masks? This is a very contentious topic, and I think most people in my space just kind of punt and they don't want to talk about it, because you're going to get a lot of haters and you're going to get some people that agree with you and some people that don't. And if my intention was just to grow a YouTube channel, then I would stay away from this topic. And a lot of people on Twitter, when I talk about this, like, oh, your followers aren't going to like that. And listen, I don't care. I don't care what my followers are going to like. No offense. But the reason I do this stuff is because I'm curious. I'm intellectually curious about the world around me. And I want to try to find truth. and I want to try to find accuracy. And if I offend people in the process, okay. If I lose subscribers, if I do whatever, it is what it is. Listen, I can't control that. I can only talk about what I like to talk about, and that's trying to figure out the world around me. So, and I'm going to make mistakes along the way. But now that I've given that disclaimer, I think it should be up to you, Catherine. That's my whole point. When I go back and forth with these people that want lockdowns or mandatory masks, or listen, I'm not saying that you shouldn't wear a mask. That's it. I am saying that it should be up to you. You should be in control of yourself. You should have the freedom and liberty to make the decisions for your own life and your family based on your own value system. And I get it. Oh, well, then you're infecting all these other people. Fine. That's not optimal, but unfortunately, we don't live in a perfect world. We live in a world of imperfect creatures, and the world itself is highly imperfect. So it's not a matter of solution, like Thomas Sowell would say. It's simply a matter of trade-offs. And unfortunately, with what we're dealing with in the world right now, the options that we have as far as trade-offs suck. They all suck. So it's about picking the least sucky of all the trade-offs. And see, what we tend to do, we get a firm position as far as, you know, whatever political narrative we agree with. And then we just like to cherry pick data. And both sides do it. It's not like one side does it and the other side doesn't. They just cherry pick data to try to confirm what their side wants to believe or what their side wants to push. And then they completely ignore all the other data, or they just try to, you know, rationalize it or something. And then, of course, they never do a cost-benefit analysis, ever. It's like people are phobic of doing a cost-benefit analysis. If the costs are in line with their narrative, then they strictly focus on the costs. And if the benefits line up with their narrative, then they strictly focus on the benefits. And they just kind of brush off the costs, right? I don't like to do that. And I said from day one, I mean, I was talking about the Cervasis thing. It's back in January, for heaven's sakes. And ironically, everybody was calling me a conspiracy theorist back in January when I started talking about the Cervasis sickness. I started talking about the countries potentially locking down. This is before they started doing. I talked about them canceling sporting events and whatnot, music events. Everyone told me I was wearing a tinfoil hat and that was ridiculous and blah, 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 blah. And ironically, those same people, most likely, that were telling me I was a conspiracy theorist, now are coming down on me because I don't think the government should be in the business of locking us in a cage. And I just think if you look at a cost benefit analysis, it really doesn't make sense. And that's what I said back then too. I said even back then, you know, when we didn't have much data, I said, okay, well, based on the data that I'm seeing here, this thing is most likely more dangerous than the flu. And again, you got to keep in mind, this was January, February. We'd have very little data. You know, now you've got all this data showing that it really only affects older age groups. But back then, it's just who knew what was going on, right? So, and it was very, and I remember it was very tough to have a stance because it's like, oh my gosh, what's going on? Holy cow, maybe we should be locking down. But in the back of my mind, and I never strayed from the opinion that this might be bad, might be worse than the flu, we don't know. But what we shouldn't do is get the government involved. The government should give us the information, and we should be able to decide for ourselves whether or not we want to wear a mask or wear an N95 mask or a little blue one or wear it across your nose or do whatever. And if you don't like it, don't go out. Lock yourself in the house. You know, but it should be your choice, right? Because I get it. If the government just locked us in our house or our homes or whatever, theoretically, let's say that you would reduce the amount of deaths. Okay, but what at what cost? At what cost? I mean, you know, what happens is people don't like to make difficult decisions. Because, and I'm not, let's just assume for a moment, and I know this is an assumption, because the data is all over the place on whether or not masks mandates work or lockdowns. You know, I did a video the other day where I would say that it's inconclusive when you look at the states compared to states and even cities compared to cities, that the like LA compared to LA 6 months ago when they have different regulations, you really don't see a correlation there. So it's tough to argue that. But what it really boils down to, let's just say for a second that lockdowns do work. Okay. So then you have to say, okay, well, how many lives is it going to save? You have to come up with a number. You do. You just do. So in the United States, let's say it's going to save an additional, and these aren't exact numbers. I'm just using them as an example. You have to say, let's say it saves an extra 300,000 lives. Okay. Then you have to say, okay, what are the costs? So in fact, I've got my whiteboard still up here. So we've got, I'll just read it right off the list. You got government power, you've got loss of freedom. You've got the deaths that occur as a result of the lockdown. Most people don't think about those. Like those deaths don't matter. Forget about it. We just want to focus on the COVID stuff, right? Or the cervasis stuff. The increased amount of mental issues, increased drug and alcohol abuse. Obviously, the economic devastation. Our economy went down, or the GDP went down by 30%+ without all the stimulus. Right. Which and what does the stimulus do? It creates havoc for future generations, not just from the standpoint of additional taxation, but because we're misallocating resources and we're creating massive amounts of malinvestment, going right back to what Mises was talking. If Mises was worried about fractional reserve banking creating malinvestment, what do you think he would do if he saw these stimulus and the government's running $5 trillion deficits? I mean, he would pass out. He'd have a heart attack, and rightfully so. So you've got the economic devastation. Obviously, you have a huge increase in poverty. I was reading a statistic that of businesses, the small and mid-sized businesses, that go that close for the lockdown, something like 40% of them will never open back up. Okay. So that is a defined cost. So you have to take all those costs together and say, okay, is the cost worth 300,000 lives? And see, nobody likes to say that because it's very uncomfortable. It's not something, it creates anxiety for us to even think about having to make that decision. But at the end of the day, that's what we're talking about. If you're someone that believes that lockdowns work. And I think the jury's out on that one. But if you believe that lockdowns work, that's the question that you have to ask in your own mind. Are 300,000 lives worth this? And if you say, well, of course, George, you can't, how do you put a price tag on human life? Okay, but how about 30,000 lives? How about 3,000 lives? You see, at some point, the cost does exceed the value of the number of human lives. And see, just for me to say that out loud, it's very uncomfortable. And I don't like to think about it. Listen, I get it. I totally get it. But you see, those are the conversations that we have to have as a society. It's not about fighting and oh, I'm right, you're wrong, you're stupid, you're a libtard, you're a flutard, whatever. Dude, No, you've got to look at reality and do a cost-benefit analysis and understand that there are no solutions. There are only trade-offs. That's it. And we have to have these discussions. And the bottom line is what's in the media, whether it's on Twitter, no one's having them because we're afraid to have them because you just don't want to suffer the consequences of, you know, being deplatformed or losing all your Twitter followers or YouTube subscribers or whatever. Listen, it's just, we're imperfect creatures living in an imperfect world. And sometimes you got to make some tough decisions, but we at least have to have those conversations. And again, I want to be crystal, crystal clear. I am not saying that lockdowns work. I'm not saying they don't work. I'm not saying that mask mandates work. I'm not saying that masks work. I'm not saying any of that. That's a completely different topic of discussion. I'm saying that there is a cost-benefit analysis to everything. And no one that I see is doing it properly or with any amount of intellectual integrity. And that's because it's a difficult topic. No one likes to talk about death or, you know, the value of a human life. And no one wants to be deplatformed. And no one wants to lose subscribers. And no one wants to deal with haters and everything. But I think if we have those discussions peacefully, and this is really important, I think that we just start having these discussions as far as the cost-benefit analysis. Oh, here we go. I went back to 2003, and I looked at all of the, we'll call them virus scares, for lack of a better word. And this is going back to 2003. We had SARS, avian, swine flu, MERS, Ebola, H1N1, Zika, Ebola again. And then, of course, we had the cerveza sickness. So in the last, call it 20 years, we've had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 in the last 20 years. So almost one every other year. So let's just say that we come to the summer and the cerveza is rear view. Okay, fantastic. What happened in 2 years when we get avian 2.0 or swine flu 2.0 or something like that? You see what I'm saying? Now that we've allowed the government to do these lockdowns, that's going to be their first response. Lockdown, lockdown. Oh, we got a lockdown. We got a lockdown. Lockdown, lockdown. Okay. Well, and you may say to yourself, well, George, that's not going to happen because it's not going to be as bad. But you don't know that. You don't know that until you start collecting the data. So they're going to have to lock down and then just wait for the data and see what happens. And what's that going to do to the economy? You see, once you allow the government to do this stuff, you've basically told them it's okay to lock me in my own house. That's okay. So they're going to exercise that power every single time they can, all in the name of safety, if the voters are voting those types of individuals into office. And it's like what I said on my I don't know that the politicians are just sitting there, you know, trying to collapse the economy. I just think that they're doing whatever they think will get them the most votes. And if shutting down the economy, if they think that'll get them reelected, that's what they're going to do. If keeping it open is going to get them reelected, then that's what they're going to do. The politicians they're like I said in my video, they're just prostitutes for votes. Come on, let's just call a spade, for heaven's sakes. So they're just going to, they're going to do whatever they think is going to get them reelected. That's the bottom line. So, like my buddy Art Berman says, the people get the politicians they deserve. So the conclusion of that video was, if you didn't watch it, was I think we're going to have to, they're going to go into lockdowns like this. Maybe let's call it once every year. Indefinitely. This is going to be a part of life in certain countries. And what's going to stop the cycle? I think It's when we get inflation. Because right now, there's this perception that we can go into lockdown and just give everyone stimulus checks, just give everyone free money, and there's like no downside to the lockdown, so why not lock down? Okay. Well, you guys know as well as I do that at some point, you're going to have to pay the fiddler. And if you keep locking down and creating fewer goods and services being created, while at the same time, you create massive amounts of currency units and just sending those checks out to where they're going to be spent with velocity, right? You're going to have that increase of inflation. And at a certain point, the pain from the increase of inflation is going to get to a point where it's higher than the pain of the perceived loss of safety from not locking down, right? I think that's what stops the cycle. So do we get that inflation in a year? Do we get it in 3 years? Do we get it in 5 years? I don't know. But I think you're going to continue to see these lockdowns because we've allowed the government to do them in the first place. And so it goes back to that cost-benefit analysis, and that's one of the big costs that nobody's talking about, that I was talking about way back in January. The long-term cost of allowing, I mean, let's look, you know, 9/11 and the Patriot Act is a great example of that. Another thing that I went through in that video. Look at all of the government regulation and intrusion into our personal lives that we have as a result of the Patriot Act that has, by the way, almost nothing to do with combating terrorism and has everything to do with the government spying on all of us and using that as justification. Well, if they've gone to that extreme with 9/11, think about the extreme that they're going to go to in the next, over the next 10 years because of what we've allowed them to do in 2020, right? And again, maybe the 300,000 lives are worth it. I'm not here to say whether that's a decision you have to make, and you have to wrestle with that on your own terms. But we've got to think about all the factors. So anyway, this was a day of tangents, guys. Sorry. I think sometimes these tangents are, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but I think they're things that we should be thinking through, and or else I wouldn't go down the tangents if I didn't think there was some value there. So hopefully you agree with me. If not, I apologize, and I'll try to stick with answering more questions next time. All right, guys. So check out Rebel Capitalist Pro if you get a chance. It's at georgegammon.com/pro. And I'm not sure how many videos I have to upload before they'll allow me to have subscribers, or maybe they'll allow it now. I don't know. Try to go to that link and see if you can subscribe. But basically, that's going to be just kind of my news channel. So it's called Rebel Capitalist, and it'll be me going on live, just talking about things that I see when I'm just going about my day-to-day research stuff. And it'll be like a live stream like this, but my face will be like right around here and the chart or the story will be kind of right here. And I'll just talk about it just like it's kind of like a Zero Hedge article. So I'm trying to do like two or three per day just to kind of keep you guys posted on the news. And that's going to be in addition to the content that I create for the George Gammon channel. The whiteboard videos and the interviews are going to be the exact same. They're not going anywhere. So this is additional content. So check that out, guys. And I will, let me do the shout outs. Yeah. Forgot about the shout outs. Okay. So we've got Mazal K, thanks for hanging out. We've got Ike E, Mark Clifford, Fatal 9998, Jan William Timmers, Joe G's Craft Cannabis Guides. I think he's here all the time. Mr. A, believe in yourself. You bet. I like that one. Igor Putsins, maybe? Igor, thanks for hanging out. Nicholas, great questions today, as always, buddy. I like big bites. Rolf Steiner, Key to Lifestyle, Upgrade, Yosemite Sam, David from New Zealand, Donald, Bear R, RT Laurie, James Carson, RR, Bernd, Andrea, good to see you. We'll see you in the member stream here pretty soon. Dwayne, Janet, Alex, Angela, Christopher Drake, JR, Quantitative Disease. Alrighty then. Oh, they're family. Holy cow. Wait. Family member Fred. So it's friend and family member Fred. That is the, and look at that. You've got my my picture of friend and family member Fred as your icon or your profile pic. That is awesome, man. Thank you very much for doing that. Super, super cool. All right, guys. Appreciate your time. Enjoy the rest of your weekend, and I will see you on the next video.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.